College leaders everywhere are facing challenging decisions in this modern era.
Have we got a stadium?
Yes.
Have we got a college?
Yes.
Or we can't support both. Tomorrow we start tearing down the college.
And decisions on the geographical makeup of the rebuilding Pac-12 haven't been easy either.
Las Vegas, Nevada.
That's how I got to Memphis. New Orleans, New Orleans.
UTSA, anyone?
Anybody going to San Antonio?
How about GCU?
Phoenix, Arizona.
Moraga?
The bells of St. Mary's.
However the geography ultimately looks, it's great to know the Pac-12 is coming back. And as it does, and when it does, the Joe Beaver Show will be along for the ride, striking that hopeful note.
These are the good old days. These are the good old days.
Brace yourselves, amigos.
Now, the Joe Beaver Show on 1240 Joe Radio.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome in. It's a very busy show in a sense. In another way, not so much, but busy in my own mind because of all the questions running through my mind for our only guest scheduled at this moment. Because there's many things we look forward to talking to him about. I mean, I feel like there would be, for me, on a very selfish note, I could talk to our guest about his father for the entire 20 minutes or so that we have with him. But he has things that I think would be interesting for us to hear as a Beaver Nation. And not just yours truly, a one-man nation, talking about George Allen and the Washington Redskins or the LA Rams and one of my heroes, the late, great Jack Pardee. Jack's son, Ted Pardee, who, like his father, played linebacker. Ted didn't go as far as Jack did. Jack was a college football Hall of Famer. He was one of the Junction Boys for Bear Bryant. So in this man's life,
really?
Jack Pardee played for Bear. He played for George Allen. And when George got the job with the Redskins, brought Jack and a number of other players with him, and the Redskins thus were known as the Ramskins, and I was a big fan because I followed my guy. I followed George, and I followed my Rams players with George to the nation's capital when George was fired after the 1970 season. Jack Pardee's son, Ted Pardee, is the radio analyst for the Houston Cougars. He will join us at 12:05. But John, as you know, you kind of begin to make the deep dive into an opponent that you don't know. I don't know much about Houston per se. Houston football, for me, my default would be not David Klingler or Andre Ware or Case Keenum, all legends in that program. Somebody says to me, name association game, Houston football. I just reeled off too many for you to play it, honestly. But I say Houston football to you. What would you have said before I just reeled off those names? Would one of those have come up or not?
No. Well, maybe. Not Pardee, I can tell
you that.
Right. By the way, you said Ted and you texted me Tim. Is it Tim?
It's
or Ted.
Tim? No, okay. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Ted Pardee.
Klingler, was he there?
Yes, yeah, he was.
That's what I would have said.
Yeah, they were an intriguing bunch, were they not? I remember 30 plus years ago being on the air looking at scores like 94-6.
Yeah, yeah. And now I do remember their glory days in the 60s and 70s.
And that's what my default, my thing would be. Oh, Bill Yeoman, because that name rings a bell.
Yeah.
And he was an innovator in college football. But Ted Pardee, the radio analyst, there, Jim Wilson, to talk about, and I promise we have. When we had the Texas Tech guy on, we had a texter say, please ask about Houston football and not just the old days. And so I want to start with this Houston team that comes in getting votes, others receiving votes category. They're 3-0. Willie Fritz in his second year doing a nice job of turning around another program. He's been involved in turnarounds in other stops in his career, most notably Tulane. He finished up at, or as Sean McDonald would say, and is it properly pronounced, those of you who are from the great state of New Orleans. Sean McDonough always says, as I always say, Canute Rockne. Sean McDonough makes it a point whenever calling a game. Well, last year at Tulane, we just slip into the, he came here after a good run at Tulane, and he was the American, don't say I saw another thing, too. How about everything? You can't keep up with things. I read something the other day about Willie Fritz, who was the back-to-back coach of the year in the American Conference, and in parentheses, the writer said, do not say AAC.
Why not?
I don't know. When did that edict get handed? You know, you get all of these notes from sports information people saying, we do not want to be referred to as Southern Cal.
Yeah, yeah.
If you're
SoCal,
USC.
Southern Cal. There was a whole list of them.
Or even, we do not want to be called SC. Okay, yeah. Well, you have fans in the stands chanting, we are SC. We are not SC. Okay, well, chant, we are not SC then, instead of we are SC. Okay, please. And now I saw something about Willie Fritz, formerly at Tulane, now the head coach at Houston in his second year, doing a heck of a job, transfer portaling in a lot of people, and doing a good job with his offense, his defense. They haven't really played, they beat Colorado soundly, but I'm still not sure they, quote, have played anybody of significance, unlike the Beavers who have. So let's take a look at their personnel and so on, and we will with Ted Pardee and get kind of a feel for this year's group. But the note on Willie Fritz is that he was the back-to-back coach of the year in the American Don't Say AAC Conference. So the American Athletic Conference, the AAC, don't say it. Out of the American Conference is how they want to be referred to now.
Well, good for him. Good for him. It's funny because when I would travel with women's basketball and get all these press guides, USC had the longest list of we do not want to be known as, do not call us. There's like five or six of
right,
them.
Right, I know.
What do you?
SoCal, Southern Cal, SC.
Well,
the Beavers play Houston Friday night, and it's a matchup that kind of gets us all digging into a little bit into who are these guys, where are these guys. And this is where I feel it's germane to our conversation in our world when we visit with Ted Pardee. And I was reminded of this, and I look forward to talking to Ted about it. I don't know if our situation will be, I hope it's not fully analogous to that of Houston. But Ted Pardee, as a proud Cougar alum, his father was a head coach there. Jack Pardee brought the run and shoot in and had a Heisman Trophy winner in Andre Ware at Houston.
Oh, yeah.
That's a tremendous accomplishment. And Jack Pardee, a defensive guy, turned Andre and that run and shoot loose, and they put up ridiculous numbers. Mm-hmm. The John Jenkins and David Klingler came in and kept that thing going.
You know, I think Jack Pardee going back to the USFL with somebody that was running that, was it the Houston Gamblers?
Yes, absolutely. You got it, Johnny.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah, because that's how he brought that system in. Having learned it from, who was that? Who was the coach of the Gamblers? Was it Mouse?
That's a good question. I'm not sure about.
And Jim Kelly was their quarterback,
yes,
by the way, before he went to the Bills. But that's how that whole, now it's all coming back to me.
Right. Yeah. So, Ted Pardee, Jack's son, joins us at 12:05. But here's where, for me, I look forward to hearing Ted's perspective. Because in getting ready for Houston, one goes back over, okay, well, who are we playing? Who are these guys? Sort of what are their roots and their history? Houston was part of the Southwest Conference for a long time.
Sure.
Which fell apart.
Right, right.
In 1996 and after the 95 season. So schools going their separate ways. Texas, Texas A&M, Texas Tech, and Baylor all into the Big 12.
That's right, which was the Big 8.
Yes, Texas Christian, TCU, SMU, and Rice to the WAC. And Houston to Conference USA.
Mm. I remember the downfall. I remember the Southwestern Conference.
It took them thus 27 years. I hope our journey in the wilderness, in a sense, is 40 years, 27 years. I hope not. And they were not, of course, in the wilderness that entire time. They had some exciting teams and programs and were relevant on certain levels through the years. Case Keenum most recently in terms of big numbers and great productivity. But it took 27 years, and even in the Houston articles and literature, it took 27 years for them, in a sense, to get whole again and to get right. Because in 2023, after, in a sense, being exiled, at least that's what it felt like,
yeah,
to a lower-level conference, mm-hmm, in 2023, 27 years after being relegated to Conference USA, and the powers, Texas, A&M, Tech, and Baylor, mm-hmm, all going in their separate ways into the Big 12.
And
now
they didn't
Texas
want Houston.
Is out of that now. They didn't want Houston. They didn't want TCU. They didn't want SMU. They didn't want Rice. And they all had to find different homes and places. 27 years later, Houston in the Big 12, pushing the top 25. They're good at 3-0, but they're back in a Power 4 conference and feel whole again. I look forward to talking to Ted about kind of all of that, the shock to the system, and then the wilderness wanderings, if you will, and how they kind of how they maintain relevance. And that's what's going to be important, in a sense, for the Beavs and the Cougs being relegated, being left behind,
right,
to keep finding ways to stay in the conversation, whether it's through dynamic offense. I think Dave or Tumwater has talked about, what was the term you used? Dave, help me a little bit. Mike Leach has a certain, like, not exit velo, but some sort of velocity thing that kept the Cougs even in a lower rung, so to speak, in a market size and all that in the Pac-12, relevant by being an air raid guy, flinging it around and making headlines with it. Mike Leach, by the way, said to Ted Pardee when he first met Ted, he said to Ted, I watched your father's games at Houston, all of them. I watched them. And he helped shape my tweaks and thinking about building out the air raid in modifications of the run and shoot. So there are many different ways we can go with Ted Pardee, the radio analyst for the Houston Cougars, and we'll try to touch on all of these. We'll start, I promise, we'll start with, tell us about Connor Wigman, your running game, your defense, your 3-0 start, and then we'll shift into things that, for me, have, in the long run, bigger picture stuff, maybe some relevance to our world now as Houston. Mm-hmm. Houston,
mm-hmm,
potential power again, back in a Power 4 in the Big 12, but it took, Johnny, 27
years. How did they handle it?
You're right.
Were they going crazy? Did the base care?
Yeah.
Because you don't think, for years you didn't think of Houston at all when you thought of college football. You did in basketball.
Yeah, you did. You did.
But not in college football.
So, and even in basketball, there was great slippage from the Olajuwon days and so on.
Yes.
And they were still part of the Southwest Conference in the Five Slamma Jamma era with Guy Lewis. But basketball has been restored by Kelvin Sampson in the modern era.
Right.
But they slipped for a long time in relevance, too. So, any thoughts on these matters? Let's get to phones, in fact, right now. The great state of Washington is well represented early on the Downward Dog phone line. Let's start with Mike in Seattle. We'll get to Tumwater. What's the term you use, Dave? He'll remind us. Some sort of exit velocity. Not exit velo. I'm thinking too much of Cal Raleigh in baseball. But something about having something that makes you stand out, that I do think the Beavers are going to find their way in the new Pac-12 world to be that team that maybe not 27 years, but can be subsumed into a Power 4 in the next wave. I think that's kind of what you're looking for and hoping for. But let's begin with Mike in Seattle with Tumwater on deck. Mike, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good, thank you. Oh,
good. Boy,
is this Bonnie? Bonnie Lake, Mike.
Yes.
Oh,
of course.
Gotcha. I was thinking of somebody else for some reason. It's good to hear your voice, Mike. Welcome.
Well, yeah, I haven't talked to you guys in quite a while, so you lose my mind, or you lose the memory of Mike in Seattle. But yes, I'm at Bonnie Lake.
Okay, gotcha.
Hey, there's been a lot of topics in the last almost a almost 10 years, it feels like, that I've wanted to call in on, or, and I've abstained because it's just too kind of painful and, you know, too much emotion, you know, and everybody's mm-hmm. got brains about things. But as you bring up the term Houston, and I saw that on the schedule, so imagine this. I'm at Sunset High School, and I'm a ball boy in the Mouse Davis era. And then he takes off, and he goes to Portland State. And I get there as a sophomore, and a coach named Pete Hopkins shows up. And I don't know where he came from, because we didn't have the internet back then, and papers and things like that didn't really talk about it. But he stands up in front of us as kids after running the run and shoot, you know,
mm-hmm.
and he says, we're going to run the Houston Veer. Have you ever heard of that offense?
No.
You say Houston Mirror?
Veer.
Oh, Veer. The Houston.
No, Veer.
Yeah, Bill Yeoman. Bill Yeoman's, yeah.
Okay, was he at Houston then?
Yes, he was. Or, and he kind of pioneered the triple option out of the split Veer.
Yeah, and so anyway, this guy shows up, Pete. And he says, yeah, you know, we're going to run the Houston Veer and we're going to pound it out after we've just been through the run and shoot and how fun that was for 5-6 years.
Yes.
And so then, you know, you were talking to Donnie Reynolds and those guys last week about, you know, that great championship run they had. And that's when Mouse had a great team. And we thought we were going to win the state championship.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And these players from Corvallis, Oregon, came up on the Dorsey buses and got off, and they take the kickoff, and I think Reynolds, think he took it back to the 50 or something, mm-hmm. and we said, oh my gosh, this is going to be a long game. So, and by the way, because Pardee, I think he had Mouse there as an offensive coordinator, maybe. Is that the timing of it?
I've got to
look. After Portland State, did he go...
I've got to look through all of that. I don't think so.
That might be the Gamblers.
Yeah, I think maybe they were connected.
Yeah, it might have been the Gamblers.
Right. They may have been connected
Pardee,
there.
Because they had Kelly there, and that's how Mouse got his name nationally going in the Jim Kelly era. So, and by the way, there is going to be a Portland State football kind of, I don't want to call it homecoming, you know, but a gathering of all the classes and all the players that want to come and even guess, because they're going to play a game at Old Civic Stadium. They're going to put goalposts back in the ground, and Portland State is going to play a home game again, and that's when they're having the homecoming and reunion of all these players. And on the invite list is Mouse Davis and his son Brad. So mm-hmm. Coach Davis is coming back to the Portland area, you know, to be around that. So if we're looking, you know, for some real history of football around the Portland area, you know, I would think Mouse has got to be at the
absolutely
at the Mount Rushmore or one of those.
No doubt.
And I remember too when Dee was kind of struggling, there was talk of having Mouse come down there and run the offense
mm-hmm.
under Coach Andros in the run and shoot. And they were going to get a guy by the name of Don Matthews, who ended up at Sunset
mm-hmm.
as the head coach. Mm-hmm. And I think John worked with him a little bit and had a hard time getting interviews, and Ron Linehan after that. But Don Matthews had played for Coach Andros over at Idaho. So, you know, all these gaps of separation, you know, we're all kind of connected, and that's why we love all this stuff so much. And so when things happen like have been happening in the last couple of 3 years, it's so painful for all of us. And
yeah. Hey, Mike.
I'm not going to be down there Friday. Yeah, go
Mike,
ahead.
Mike, tell me again. John and I were we were off air briefly confirming something. Mouse did work on Jack's Gambler's staff in the USFL, Jack Pardee, in 1984. But quickly, when is this Portland State event? I've been reading and hearing about a game at Civic Stadium or Multnomah or Providence Park.
Yeah.
When is it exactly?
Well, I don't have it memorized right this minute as I'm driving around Bonnie Lake.
It's all right.
But my good friend Rob Kloss mm-hmm. got me the website invitation, and on there's people that can click and put their name in that they're coming, and And it's open to anyone, I think, you know, that's interested in Portland State and Portland State football and the history. And on there was like Neil Lomax and some others. And on there is Mouse Davis and Brad Davis. So I'll get you that information.
Yeah, please. But, and we'll look into it on our
that
own.
That would be, because I know John Canzano, who I really like and some don't, but I really like him. You know, he's been really banging the drum that the travesty of the city of having Portland State go out to Hillsboro, you know, has been a real, I'll say, hindrance. And he's really saying that we got to get the Portland State games back into the park blocks there.
Yes.
So that people can come down and support again. Because if they don't get that thing fixed, they're probably not going to be football much longer. And if there's not football, it's going to be then hard to have the non-revenue sport. So I'll get you those dates, and that would be a good little road trip for you guys to go up there maybe on a Friday. You know, like you've done before, and maybe Kerry Eggers has some input too. But it was a great time in that Portland era of football in high school and then college, you know, with Portland State. Man, that was they were putting all kinds of points up. So
indeed. Great to talk to you, Mike. Good to hear your voice. And please, you're not there Friday, I hear. Yeah. You're not coming Friday, but we'll see you down the road, I hope.
No. Yeah, and I don't, and I've got some tickets available, so I could make them, but I can give them to you guys if you want to auction them off or have a raffle or something like you do at your offsites. I don't know.
Well, we have a road show.
Yeah,
we have a road. No, we have a road show Thursday, and if you want to convey those tickets somehow for us to give away as part of that road show event, we'd appreciate it very much, Mike.
Yeah.
So please be in touch with us.
Okay. Very good.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
Okay, I will. Thank you.
Good to hear from you. By the way, Thursday, Timber Hill. We've never done a road show at Timber Hill at their athletic club. Up in the Timber Hill area. I mean, I've been there many times.
Me
I don't
too.
Don't exactly have a street address unless it's been put in here in the general information. But we will be at Timber Hill Athletic Club, not tomorrow, but Thursday between 11 and 1 for our first ever road show. And this is a road show put together by one of our sales representatives, not named Doug Blair, who's put together most of these. Chelsea's put together a road show for this Thursday, 11 to 1, at Timber Hill Athletic Club, serving the community since 1980. We'll get an exact address in because you all know how to get there, but you still got to plug it into your phone in the modern era to make sure you get there this time. But that'll be 11 to 1, and we'll tell you more about the roadshow, but it sounds like we'll at least have a pair of tickets or two from Mike from Seattle, Mike and Bonnie Lake, getting us started today. Now let's go north to Tumwater. We're staying in the great state of Washington for Dave. Dave, good morning. Good to hear from you. Welcome to the Joe Beaver Show.
Good morning, guys. Just the conversation this half hour has given me three things to respond to, and which is none of which was my original reason for calling. So the term you're trying to remember, Mike, is escape velocity.
Yeah, escape velocity. Thank you.
So when Mike Bellotti brought in Chip Kelly, he achieved escape velocity with the offensive innovation. And regarding Houston's fate, I'm just sitting here reflecting as you went through that history. It occurs to me that three universities really are at the root of all of the problems of college football realignment, et cetera. And they are USC, Notre Dame, and Texas. They are at the root of all, at one time or another, they have a hand in everything that plays out. And I can elaborate on that, but at the risk of cutting off myself with the other things I wanted to say, but when you want to start ascribing blame to how did college football get to where they are, these are the universities, they're media partners to this, SC, Texas, Notre Dame, they're the root of all these problems.
Okay.
And lastly, in terms of new business, it is, in fact, pronounced Tulane, not Tulane.
Yeah, no, I know.
Interesting.
I believe you, and when Sean McDonough, and he's the one I hear doing Tulane games and saying, well, when he was at Tulane, it's never come naturally for me to say it that way, but I think Saturday or Friday night, when I say Willie Fritz, the two-time American Conference Coach of the Year when he was at Tulane, I will do that for you. Hmm. And who were you saying? A friend confirmed that?
Well, a friend of my son's went to Tulane, and when he came home from Christmas vacation that first year, everyone was asking, "Well, how's everything at Tulane?" He said, "Well, first of all, it's pronounced Tulane," and conversation went on from there.
There we go.
So here are the reasons I dialed up originally. As you know, I'm fond, as miserable as Beaver Nation feels. It's always helpful to know that you've got company in your misery. So, for example, if you're an Oklahoma State fan, Mike Gundy got fired today.
Mm.
And for those out there, and I see them online that says, Oregon State, we got to get rid of Coach Bray. We got to make a big hire. The biggest name hire in the history of college football, Bill Belichick, is a failure. It's not going to work out there. Yeah. It's done. It's over. So I just want to throw that cautionary note.
Okay.
And for people who think that losing to Oregon in a convincing fashion in the Civil War, as if that's never happened before, I'd just like to remind people and this is another one of my main themes. It's going to be my theme for as long as I live, I think, or until we get past 2030, 2031, and we see what the final resolution of all of this business is. But looked at from a strategic perspective, not institutional ego and hurt feelings, because when you go to a family Thanksgiving dinner, those people have a bigger, better, more money for their football team than you do, and all that nonsense, which informs so much of the dialogue out there in Beaver. I'm really not criticizing. I'm just trying to explain what's going on. Looked at from a strategic perspective, there's something worse than getting beat big time by the University of Oregon, even if getting beat often by a big time Oregon program. And that's where Oregon State is going to be when it plays App State in 2 weeks. That game is going to be on ESPN+. That is worse than getting beat by Oregon big, because that is the true obscurity. And looked at from a strategic standpoint, what the Oregon State and Washington State programs need to do for a five-year period. We're not just talking about two, but five. They need to remain visible, which is why playing the Civil War game routinely is so important. Everyone, it's visibility.
Mm-hmm.
It's eyeballs. Mm-hmm. That's what it's all about.
Yeah.
Two last points. If I know you got to get to a break. Now we have the other coach in the truncated Pac-12 having to apologize. The Cougar coach apologized because in his post-game press conference Saturday night, he bemoaned the fact that Washington's got a $30 million payroll and he doesn't have those assets.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I don't want to engage in that kind of excuse making. We could have played better. Or Washington State had beaten Washington just a year ago at their place. So that was inexcusable. And lastly, I would just say this in terms of continuity of theme. I didn't watch the game on Saturday. You don't have enough time in this call to go into that. But I did listen to John's post-game call-in show, and you guys mentioned it a little in your dialogue with each other yesterday, and that is our current Malik Murphy's lack of willingness to tuck the ball
mm-hmm.
and run.
Mm-hmm.
If that's true, and I think there's credible authority for that being the case, including John Warren and yourself who saw the game, and there's a pattern going back further, that means thus and therefore that the lack of a completely well-rounded quarterback position player continues now, by my estimation, at least going all the way back to Sean Canfield and maybe Matt Moore. And that is the fundamental problem Oregon State football has had now for going on almost 15 years. So the good, the bad, and the ugly. Thanks for taking my call. As usual on a Tuesday, I got to get to Rotary. Thanks for hearing me out.
Have a good time, Dave, heading to Rotary. Tomorrow, I won't be here, by the way. I was asked by Mike Colgill. We'll take a break on this note. Back in July, back in the sunny, happy, comfortable days of July when I was 0-0 and thinking about being 3-1 or 4-0 or 2-2 at least. And I was invited by Mike, and Mike once asked John Wooden to speak at the fraternity house, and John said yes. So if Mike Hogill asked me on behalf of the Albany Chamber of Commerce to speak, and he once asked John Wooden to speak, and John said yes, how could I possibly? Mike, no, I don't think I can do that. But in July, it's easy to, oh, yeah, I thought the invitation might be rescinded, by now coming in at 0-4. That's what Joe Buzis used to say, losing announcer. That year we went 45-96 with Charlie Manuel, Pat Casey, Jim Wilson, Billy Bean, Alvaro Espinoza, Terry Forster, and on. I would walk in after we had a 14-game losing streak and 11-game. I'd walk in and Joe, look at me, you losing announcer, like it was my fault. So that's sort of how I've always felt. I feel like a losing announcer right now. But I won't be here tomorrow. You and Brooks Hatch will be hosting the show. Then we'll be at Timber Hill on Thursday and back on Friday. But off to Rotary. And it's important, I think, to part of the reason, to be honored to be asked at all to get in front of any whatever size of the group of people they invite you, I think you almost always say yes to those types of things. Mm-hmm. I've had to say no on other requests, not many, but every once in a while because of the show. 11-1 and noon luncheons, Rotary that Dave's off to, and an Albany Chamber luncheon tomorrow. I've generally said I just can't do it. But in this case, when Mike Cogill asked and all that Mike's done for us over the years, I was honored to be asked and grateful to be able to say yes. So thank you for holding down the ship tomorrow.
Yeah, no, Brooks, he'll come in. We'll have some fun.
Let's take a break. We'll come back and open phones and texts. 541-497-5356. 541-497-5356. We've had two calls today from the great state of Washington. If anybody closer to home is listening and wants to contribute, feel free, either via the text line or the Downward Dog phone line. Great to have you with us on the Joe Beaver Show.
Welcome back to the Joe Beaver Show. Start your stopwatches. Let's see how long this music has to play before Parker's ready to go.
How about 3 or 4? 1 second, 2 seconds. Come on now.
That was funny that. Because you were kind of walking.
I was sort of out of the room
from the other side.
No question.
That's funny.
Derek, who put that together with a late Harold Page. Mr. Harold, right? Mr. Page?
Well, I don't know his first name, but Mr. Page.
Mr. Page. What a wonderful voice.
He was a theater guy. Didn't know anything about sports.
A little bit like John Facenda?
Yeah.
Or John Facenda, who John wasn't a sports
fan
either.
No, he was a theater guy.
But he would speak authoritatively.
Oh, gosh. One of the most amazing voices.
Exactly.
In all of history. You have to YouTube stories. There's some Sable... Steve or Ray, I can't remember which one, but it's on camera showing him and working with him and as he's doing voiceovers. And then the flubs where he gets mad and swears and stuff.
Oh, really? Yeah. I didn't know John Facenda was capable of that.
Yeah, I know.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome in. 541-497-5356.
There's a text here we got early before the show or right around the show from Sydney, and it's about baseball. And she sent two. She said, it's official, and it's a tweet from Jeff Passan, Major League Baseball. Major League Baseball will implement a challenge system for balls and strikes in the 2026 season after the league's competition committee voted to usher in the era of robot umpiring. Teams will receive two challenges to dispute calls by the home plate umpire. Then she goes on to write, personally, I absolutely love this, and I'm so glad they approved it. I don't want full 100% robo-umps because that would eliminate the art of catching, but having challenges available allows players and teams to hold umps accountable in big moments and removes some of the officiating crew's ability to dictate the outcome of ball games, which they should never be able to do. The challenge system feels like a necessary middle ground to preserve the integrity of the game, and I think it's worked great in the spring training and minor league games I've watched this season. And didn't they also use it in the All-Star game?
Perhaps.
I think they did, as far as just balls and strikes.
Was it used?
I think so.
I don't remember the storyline along those lines. But thank you, Sydney. And I think it's a good thing in terms of it's not going to be overdone. And it's two challenges per game per team? Is that the idea?
Okay.
I can live with it.
As long as it doesn't drag. Now, when I saw it, it must have been the All-Star game. It worked well. Mm-hmm. It actually worked well.
If you have any initial reaction to that, feel free at 541-497-5356. I thought for a moment Sidney, who is a consummate Beavers baseball fan and Mariners fan, Gary Hill, by the way, will join us Thursday. We're coming to you Thursday from Timber Hill Athletic Club in Northwest Corvallis, 11 to 1. We hope you'll join us. We'll give you a little more detail about the amenities of that event later in the show, but we hope to see you on Thursday, and John and Brooks will be holding down the fort here tomorrow. 541-497-5356, the Downward Dog phone line, the University Honda text line. If you have any sort of initial reaction to what Major League Baseball has apparently decided to do, and Jeff Passan reports and confirms that a challenge system for balls and strikes will be introduced to Major League Baseball next year. When she said Jeff Passan confirms, I know one can't, in a sense, confirm an opinion, but I thought that Sidney was going to say that Passan has confirmed that he thinks that Cal Raleigh should be the MVP of the American League.
Yeah, that remains to be seen.
It is. I think it's going to be one of the closest votes ever. I really do.
There's been a lot of talk about it and how close it is. I mean, depending on who you ask, it's a 50-50 deal.
And even with the thing that gave me some semblance of hope that maybe, just maybe, an East Coast bias or New York Yankees big market bias wouldn't be the prevailing factor was hearing our own good friend Steve Cannon through the years, lifetime Yankees fan. When I talk about consummate for Sidney on the Beavers and Mariners, Cannon, all things New York and the Knicks and the Rangers and the Yankees in particular, the Giants, and even the I think he's been just a consumer of everything there. A Mets fan when it matters in 69 or 86, the New York Jets, Super Bowl III. I mean, he has memories of all of these things and was a fan as a young kid of all those things going on. But first and foremost, I think a Yankee guy.
Mm-hmm.
But when he, that lifelong Yankee guy, said to me in a conversation we had the other day when he honored me to have me on as a guest last week ahead of the Civil War, I asked him near the end of the conversation about his thoughts on Raleigh v. Judge, and Steve Tannen went with Raleigh. And that, for a moment, from a guy who has looked his entire life through the Yankees lens, that gave me hope. I'm hoping that he's not alone. You know what I'm saying,
yeah.
John?
Yeah.
No, I mean, that other people who have a vote, if a lifelong Yankees fan can look at the amazing year Judge is having, and it is incredible, but
TJ
also
thinks
see
it's
beyond
go.
It.
TJ thinks the Riders will go with...
with Judge.
With Judge.
Yeah.
He says it should be Raleigh. He wants Raleigh, mm-hmm. but he thinks that's the way it will go. Now, that was a couple of days ago. Things can change in this last week. And this is, you know, starting tonight, a big run. These last six games, I don't know how many games or who the Yankees are playing, but I know the Mariners tonight against Colorado and then on Friday against the Dodgers and Ohtani and all of that could be mm-hmm. kind of a center stage
right.
type of thing.
It could be. Yeah, and if the Mariners clinch a Western title and Raleigh hits a 61st home run and catches Judge at 62 in that weekend, maybe that's enough on a national stage.
Or hits one off of Kershaw.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
In his last start,
maybe hits one from the right side and the left side off of Kershaw.
Man.
You know what I'm saying? I mean, what Mike just referred, Dave and Tumwater referred to as the escape velocity and staying visible in a national picture. Having a game like that and a series like that with so much on the line coming down the stretch of a season might be enough, as you're hinting, to swing some votes.
Yeah, because it seems like it's that close. Yeah. Patrick from San Diego writes in. He says, this should be a fun Friday night game. One, 1989 Heisman Trophy winner Andre Ware will be in the booth with ESPN.
Yes, he will, and he's a great Cougar proponent, ambassador. Loved the late Jack Pardee and gave Jack so much credit for launching his career to Heisman status at Houston. But the sports information director, the Steve Fink, the Sean Scheffler, Hank Hager of Houston,
mm-hmm.
went to Wilsonville High School, wanted to come to Oregon State, ended up not happening. He went to Grand Canyon University. I think he's in his fifth year at Houston. He and I have had some conversations this week.
Wow.
Big Oregon State guy, but he says Andre is fair. He's a Coug through and through,
yeah.
So we will have that Friday night. but that he's a good analyst and very objective.
That is a great small world story. Two, UH fans have a downtown bar already picked out for their pregame. I don't know what that means because Patrick's from San Diego.
Okay.
And three, GoCougs.com, GoCougs.com, has a recap of the 1970 OSU-UH game with a quote from Coach DeAndros.
Yes, and Patrick did not add... Jim Wilson and I, I'm sure, will talk about this in the Holland-America matchup. It's a good write-up, isn't it, Patrick, if you read it? But the quote, John, the quote in that story, in the Holland-America matchup feature that we'll be doing come Friday night, I love it because you don't see this very often. After the game, and the Beavers had a 16-12 lead late, the Beavers had a defensive lineman named Mark Dipple, Medford High School, friends with Scott Spiegelberg. We may even try to get Mark on either Thursday or Friday just to kind of revisit this. The last time the two teams played was in the Astrodome in 1970. Houston was a 18.5-point favorite. Cool. They were ranked number 19 in the country. They were one of the top programs in the country and a big favorite, and the Beavers led 16-12 late. Mark Dipple exchanged punches with the Houston starting quarterback, Moon Mullins. Moon and he exchanged punches. Both were ejected out of the game. The backup quarterback leads a late touchdown drive.
Oh.
And the Beavers lose 19-16 to Houston in the last time the two teams got together. After the game, in the game story, quote, "I'm sick we lost because we deserve to win," said Oregon State head coach Demosthenes Andrikopoulos. They referred to our DeAndros as Demosthenes Andrikopoulos in their game story and quoted him thusly.
I've never seen that before.
Not in print. I mean, I knew that's his name, and he was shortened up to DeAndros, but I've not seen in a game story in print a writer said Oregon State head coach Demosthenes Andrikopoulos.
I love it.
Thank you, Patrick, for that.
Good
write-up.
Good job on the name. That's not an easy name. I know that. Dean from Albany, and this is funny because I get this. He says, Houston football is Bum Phillips, Earl Campbell, and Dan Pastorini. I don't think of Houston Cougars when you say Houston football.
No, I know.
I mean, most people don't.
Yeah, if I say Houston football, you might think Warren Moon, too.
Yeah, even Warren Moon, the Oilers, and those great helm logos.
Yep.
Oh, man, they should have never changed that.
Thank you,
that.
Dean. That's a good one.
That's Dean. Let's see. Mike in Seattle gave us the link to the PSU stuff.
Okay, and I hope tickets that we can convey at the Roadshow Thursday. He's kind enough to offer those up. Thank you, Mike. Pressure.
Cal in Kaiser says, Tummy is throwing 98 on the black today.
Okay.
So he's very much in favor of things that Dave says. Schedule question. Do you plan to be on Friday, or will you forego the usual programming since you two are booked at the game?
Well, the game's late enough that we'll be on the fan on Friday. Yeah. We'll be here. 11-1. A full Joe Beaver show. Thank you for asking and Karen.
Yesterday, CVB says, we didn't need no damn trophy. The right to live in the state was enough.
Well, here's my question, too, on that, everybody. The platypus trophy as a thing, has it ever been? I'm just asking those of you who've been around this thing longer than we have, and we're neophytes in this whole thing. We're 27 years in, day to day. Was there ever a time when Tommy or Kaz or whomever would, we just won the platypus trophy? I mean, has it ever been a big deal is what I'm asking those of you who've been around a lot longer. I sure hope we won the platypus trophy. I don't remember that conversation in my lifetime from 1973 to now. Was it ever a big deal is what I'm asking. Do you want it to be a big deal? Do you support Canzano and others for kind of pushing it? Should we try to create something along those lines?
I think if there was going to be a push to create something along those lines, it would have happened a lot longer before the collapse, because right now it doesn't seem like a civil war. Doesn't seem like it's a rivalry game or anything like that. So now to try to bring that forward, it's like, might be a little too late.
Yeah, and I guess, again, I'm just wondering, has it ever, was it ever, in your own mind as a longtime fan of the program, a deal, a thing? So that's a thing. I mean, that's what we reduce many things to. Oh, is that a thing? Like, is that something tangible and real? Is that a thing? Was it ever a thing? I'm asking anybody. feel free to text or call if you remember. Oh, yeah, I remember. We used to talk about. I'm just saying, in my lifetime in this world.
I've never heard of it.
Up here since 1973. Never really heard of it.
Well, we've heard
I've
of
read
the trophy.
Articles about
yeah.
it. And,
there's been attempts before to try to revive it.
But has it ever taken, so to speak?
No, I don't think so.
Ever.
I'll bet not.
Okay.
Patrick writes in and says, update, my bad, the UH fans have a Corvallis downtown bar. Now, that makes sense.
Well, Patrick.
Treebeard's Tap House, Corvallis, right in downtown.
Oh, my gosh. Treebeard's is one of my favorite spots in terms of playing trivia there on Tuesday nights over the last several summers. Chris Pendleton and his wife have been down there. Mitch Canham and Chris came. And the team I was on, we kind of obliterated them. And Chris said, we ain't coming back here anymore. So we got Coach Pendleton at Treebeard's.
Was it
and
sports
sent
trivia?
Somewhere else. No, it's all trivia, general trivia. I've enjoyed playing there over the. So Treebeard's, I got to find out from the proprietor, Dave, at Treebeard's, good spot downtown, kind of the why and the wherefore and how. Is there a Houston alumni group in our town?
Yeah.
And if so, we want to hear from one of you. How, you know, rally it up and
if
get
if they're doing
get
a bar
the
thing, there's got to be a bunch of Houston
so
people.
So that's,
here.
I guess, again, as we've asked over the years, and we're always sort of surprised, Houston alums out there? So how big is the program and football and all of that to you? Feel free to give us a call, and maybe we'll try to find a representative and have them on as the week goes. We'll take a final break this hour on the Joe Beaver Show.
All right, just a couple of minutes left in the program, Doc.
Hey, Josh, jump in here for a second. Can you turn? Do we have a third microphone
yes.
for Josh Grossman? He and Chelsea have put together the roadshow for Thursday at Timber Hill Athletic Club, a place that I've enjoyed good workouts in. You have, too. We've seen a lot of people in the community there over the years since 1980. Josh, your first ever roadshow there. I know you and Chelsea and Jason and so on have worked on this within the station, but what's the big hit, the thing that they're really trying to get people to experience? What do you know about this golf simulator thing?
Well, I know that it's a deal they're trying to set up for winter golfers that, you know, can avoid going out and golfing in the rain and in snow. I think there's multiple courses that they can play. They're trying to form a league. I know that. So it's something that you could be a part of. It can be a social thing. There's available food and drink for those things where I think it's by purchase, but you can definitely form a team or a league within it and then try that out and golf all winter long and keep track and kind of have a fun thing to where you're having some competition as well.
Do we know, Josh, if at the roadshow there's going to be an opportunity, as you say, quote unquote, to try it out?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
That is going to be, anybody can come and try out the golf simulator there.
Cool.
On Thursday.
On Thursday between 11 and 1. Thanks for that, Josh. We'll see you up there. We'll have football tickets to give away, several pair for the Friday night game. We'll be there Thursday, 2855. We hope you lock it into your phone and come join us. 2855 Northwest 29th, Timber Hill Athletic Club with a new golf simulator. And check out the fitness facilities, the huge weight room, the circuit training room, a lot of family-friendly things. Pickleball, I first discovered pickleball there watching the late Ken Johnson and others playing a pretty serious and exciting game of pickleball. The indoor golf league with a golf simulator that Josh just talked about. So that's the place to be. We hope you'll join us this Thursday, 11 to 1, our first ever roadshow at Timber Hill Athletic Club, 2855 Northwest 29th. Many things to discuss with the radio analyst for the Houston Cougars, Ted Pardee, coming up after our top of the hour break. Thanks for joining us today on 1240 Joe Radio.
For so very long, it's been...
Go on, George. Tell how it's gonna be.
But in the end, the commish only said...
We figured it 17 different ways. And every time we figured it, it was no good. Because no matter how we figured it...
But no matter how you figure it out, I still don't get as much as anybody else.
Somebody don't like the way we figured it. So now, there's only one way to figure it. And that is every man for himself.
When Black Friday comes...
This is the end.
It's the end of the world.
It's the end of the world.
Or is it now? As a new year hits, through it all, Beaver Nation moves ahead with resiliency and hope.
Sun's up, looks okay, the world survives into another day.
See clearly now, the rain is gone.
And the way forward goes through, as it must, The Joe Beaver Show with John Warren and Mike Parker.
A number of times I heard these guys' voices over and over and over. Still can't find it.
Ah, can't find it? We can help.
This here is 1240.
1240.
It's always been 1240.
My client says it's 1240.
Yeah, plus 93.7 FM and streaming live at KEJOAM.com and on the KEJO app. It's The Joe Beaver Show.
We head into the second hour. Mike Parker with John Warren, as the man said. And it is a true pleasure. So many different directions I'd love to go with our next guest, kind enough to join us from Houston, the radio analyst for Houston Cougar football, Ted Pardee, who played linebacker at Houston, working the game Friday night at Reser Stadium in Corvallis. And Ted, let's just start. I appreciate you taking time, and I mean that sincerely. There's so many different things that we'd love to talk to you about, including one of my heroes, your father, Jack. I loved him as a linebacker with George Allen's Rams and then with George's Redskins and the Super Bowl team of 72. So I want to get to that in a moment, but I get people saying you guys go down memory lane so much you don't always hit the current stuff. So before we do some of the other big things in your life and your life experience, perhaps let's start with the game itself, the season that the Cougars are having thus far at 3-0, coming to Corvallis Friday. Your thoughts about your team thus far and the matchup in Corvallis.
Mike, it's a pleasure to speak with you, and you and I could talk for a couple hours here about football, but we'll keep it short. You know, look, the Houston Cougars are a team that's really been in transition with Coach Willie Fritz coming in last year, taking the place of Dana Holgorsen. The program had to reboot, and that was really what last year was for the University of Houston. In the off season, they had 40 plus newcomers coming into the program, and that's, I guess today that's not a big deal, but boy, I tell you, I can't even imagine what having 40 new guys and guys on the roster is like, and trying to coach them up. In addition to that, let's not forget head coach Willie Fritz also had to replace offensive coordinator and defensive coordinator. He brought Slade Nagel with him, or brought him over. Slade had been with him at Tulane back when they beat USC, so there was some experience there. And then brought in Austin Armstrong to be the defensive coordinator. So really complete turnover if you think about it, Mike. And what I am most excited about is the fact that the newcomers have really started to gel as a team, led by Connor Wegman, quarterback transfer from Texas A&M. So, I want to set the stage there. The Cougars are really a new group this year. It's even different than they were last year, but they've really started to come together as a team, which is great.
Ted Pardee, Houston radio analyst, joining us. You mentioned the quarterback. It already has us kind of tossing and turning as Beaver fans because of his escapability, his ability to make plays with his legs, coming off a career high in rushing in the win over Colorado, 2 rushing touchdowns, plus he can sling it around a little bit too. Connor Wegman, tell us about Connor a little bit more and the escapability part of his game.
You know, the thing that when you first see Connor Wegman, he looks like a classic, Texas high school football quarterback gunslinger, right? He's 6'3", 210. He doesn't look overly muscular or overly, he doesn't look like a track athlete. He looks like your classic, Texas high school quarterback. But when you watch him on the field, you can't help but notice he has a rare quick twitch running style. When he was in high school, he played at a brand new high school in Houston called Bridgeland High School. He brought them as a new high school to the Texas High School Playoffs, which is a really big deal. And that's why Texas A&M was on him. He was really one of the top 5 quarterbacks in the nation at the time. As a high school athlete, he was a dual threat guy. He was truly a dual threat guy. He went to A&M. He was more of a passer. They had some offensive line problems there. He got beat up and was injured, lost his starting job, and that's how he landed at Houston ultimately. There's even a family connection there where Connor Wegman's dad, you know, way back in the old days, had played for Willie Fritz in one of Willie Fritz's early jobs. And that's really what, if I could explain football in the state of Texas to you, that's really what it's so much about here at the University of Houston, is finding those personal ties, finding those generational ties to the program and to the coaches, and taking advantage of that. And I'll just tell you that Connor Wegman has done a great job of winning over the fans and winning over his teammates.
Ted Pardee joining us on the Joe Beaver Show. Thank you for that breakdown, but what else? Dean Connors is running it well. Tanner Koziol is catching it well. Maybe as good a tight end as 17 receptions, leads the Big 12, and he caught 94 last year. I mean, Connor, it looks like Slade Nagel's offense is diversified enough that there's a lot of ways this team can hurt you. What do you make of the offensive approach so far?
Well, I think what Slade wanted to do offensively is he wanted to run more 12 personnel, so one back, two tight ends. He wanted to be able to combat the defense that's really popular in football today. Is that, you know, you hear it called a 4-eye. Some people call it 4-eye. Some people call it the mini defense. It's really the defense that Nick Saban established when he was at Alabama. Nick Saban started this defense that has your two tackles, your defensive tackles are lined up in what's called a four technique, an inside four technique, and then you've got an outside rush end. It causes problems for the spread offense. And down, you know, obviously so many teams have loved to throw the ball around. That offense makes it really, or that defense makes it really hard for spread offenses to run. So how do you combat that? You put an extra big man on the field. You put that tight end on the field, and you force the defense to go with a true four-down lineman, and it really evens the playing field. That's the first step to getting a good running game. Next thing you do, you bring in a running back who's established, who knows how to play the game, and I'll tell you, Dean Connors, he came from Houston's crosstown rival, Rice University. So this is a kid who's really smart. He's actually from Hawaii. He played high school ball in Hawaii. He got recruited by Rice, mainly probably because he was undersized at the time at 6 foot and 200 pounds. Originally, he's 205. But Dean Connors he's a very smart player. He's really good in this running scheme. So you kind of combine Tanner Koziol, who also transferred, right? From, you know, he's a transfer and as a 6'7", 250-pound tight end, he's a receiving tight end. He can block, of course, but he's got great hands. So that combination has really been something that I think Slade Nagel really wanted to maximize when he came to the University of Houston.
This is John with Mike. I want to go back a little bit to the point about the down linemen, the defensive guys. Why do you think that kind of wreaks havoc on teams that want to pass it around a lot?
Well, the old 4-eye defense was one that's been really popular when Air Raid kind of took over. And everybody started having those 55 to 58 games in the Big 12 a few years ago. You remember those games?
Yeah.
And even in the Pac 12, you guys started to see it too. And it basically spread all across football. The defensive guys had to figure out a way to stop it. And that offense only works. The pass is used to set up the run. It's kind of counterintuitive, right? It's kind of like the run and shoot back when I played at the University of Houston. You know, the run and shoot was pass first to set up a great running game. And we had an incredible running back named Chuck Witherspoon who ran, he still holds yards per carry records here at the University of Houston. So what do you need to do with that? Well, obviously you need to have a lot of defensive backs in the field to stop that offense. But the way that you set your defensive line up in that inside four technique on both ends makes it really difficult for those guards and tackles to get their blocks when they're trying to do typical zone type blocking. So that was the first chess piece move. Now what you had was Nick Saban come in and say, okay, I'm going to take this and I'm going to create the mini defense, which adds basically two walk-up linebackers outside of that. So it turns that three down lineman front into a five-man front, it looks a lot like the old 50 defense from the 1970s. And then you can actually, and if those guys are really athletic, then they can drop into coverage or they can run the stop the run. That has basically come into the Big 12. It's come into the SEC. Everybody's running it. Georgia runs it probably as well as anybody does right now. And that shuts that air raid offense down. So the only way to combat that is to add another big man offensively, get a big body on the line, go with the 12 personnel, two tight ends, get an extra tight end on the line. Then the defense is going to have to substitute and get a bigger guy out there and get one of those defensive backs off the field. And then that thing's, then it allows your running game to work. And then it also, in a funny way, it opens up the passing game.
Thank you for an excellent breakdown of these things. I feel like I want to listen back to the tape, take notes, and be prepared. That's excellent stuff, Ted. But you've touched
on...
Sorry, I may be boring you to death here. We love it, and it's great, and we don't get that kind of inside baseball stuff that often. I thank you for that. But in talking about all of that, it got me thinking about the air raid and the cyclical nature, I guess. You know, an offense will gain an edge or a defense will do some things that causes the offense. It's an everlasting chess match, right? And you have a relationship of sorts, and having played in the run and shoot, and then Mike Leach said to you when Mike, the late great, was developing his air raid and perfecting it, that he watched your dad's teams, I've read. He watched your teams and Andre Ware and so on, and took it in another direction, but built a lot of it on those principles. What would you say about what Leach said to you about the evolution of offense that you're talking about?
Well, Coach Leach was somebody that if you ever got to know him, you instantly loved him. He was just a great guy. Somebody you want to just talk ball with. I mean, just have a conversation about it. And he paid me the ultimate compliment by sharing that story with me, and my sons are coaches, and they got to know him as well, and what a great ambassador of football and a great competitor. But I think that today, even Coach Leach, who was committed to his system that he and Hal Mumme invented, which was the air raid, and it was basically the run and shoot. They took it to version 2.0, right? Mm-hmm. They took it to a different level. And that's what smart coaches do, is they take something that's good and they make it better. And so, you know, in today's world, I think Coach Leach would be using more 12 personnel. He'd be using more, you know, tight ends.
Mm-hmm.
Mainly because you can get a guy like when you look at Kojal, the tight end for Houston on paper, 6'7", 250, you think, oh, well, he must be a big stiff. You know, he probably right. should be an offensive tackle, right? But when you watch him run, he runs like a receiver. And so that is a special talent. That is a special, they looked for him. They wanted that type of guy because that can keep those defenses honest. Can he do a good job blocking? Absolutely. But if you need him to split out as a receiver, he's a dangerous receiver. And I think we see it in the NFL today. Like, look at George Kittle with the 49ers. Look at, there's a lot of great tight ends in the NFL. They're big, tall guys who are not afraid to block. And that's what I like about George Kittle in particular. He is a great blocker. He takes a lot of pride in blocking. But, man, if you need a great, tough catch, George Kittle can also make that catch. And that's kind of what college football is trying to emulate today. They're trying to find those guys, that diamond in the rough.
Wow. Ted Pardee joining us. Ted, again, we could just talk football like this the rest of the hour, but in our remaining minutes, and I really do appreciate your time, maybe if you could reflect a little bit on your dad, the late, great Jack Pardee, whom I loved as a kid. I'd go to the Coliseum and watch George Allen's teams play. I also read that he played for Bear Bryant and was one of the Junction Boys. So we're talking about incredible. What, as you grew up, you missed those Rams years with him. You were young in the last couple, and then the Redskins years. I mean, I loved your dad and the way he played and the way George Allen coached him up. What kind of stories did you kind of hear about Bear and George as you grew up and the influence they had on his life?
Well, you know, I was a coach's kid, and so when everybody goes to, you know, the family dinner table and you're going to eat dinner at night, you know, my dad would come home for dinner and he'd ask us about our day, and he would coach us, Dad, I was in in math class, and I really struggled. And, you know, he turned it all into a coaching opportunity. And I appreciate that so much today I've been in the computer software business for 33 years. So I took a completely different direction than my dad did. My two sons are both college and pro coaches right now. My older son coaches in the UFL in the spring. He was the interim head coach of the San Antonio team. And then my younger son is quarterbacks coach at UIW in San Antonio, which is a D1 FCS school. And, you know, it really taught me, my dad taught me what all the core virtues of life are really all about: hard work, not letting the negatives and the negativity of the world around us get us down, to be leaders of men and to help other people. Really, you know, that sort of core philosophy is what my dad believed in, was helping others be successful. And if you can help somebody else be successful, then guess what? Maybe you'll be successful too. And that's really been sort of a core philosophy that I learned from my dad, and I appreciate so much. And I had the pleasure, you know, I'm the youngest of five, so I was the baby in our family, and I was blessed to be able to play for my dad for three of the 4 years that I was in college. Mm-hmm. He was my head coach, and I got to know a side of my dad that I really cherish. And I talk to my siblings about it often, that, you know, that I wish my siblings could have played. You know, I had three sisters, so they couldn't. But I really wish that they could have really interacted with Dad on the football field the way that I got to. I got to see the business side. I got to understand how he operates, how organized and disciplined he was. And I use all of that in my business today as a leader in the computer software business. I use everything that my dad taught me, and I think they're just great core values for all people when it comes down to it. It's all about the basics, right? Treat each other with love and respect. Try to be a good leader, leader of men. And as a leader, you know, it's important for us to help others. And that's really what it's all about.
Ted Pardee, Houston radio analyst, our guest on the Joe Beaver Show. Ted, like your father, you were a linebacker. You were on the other side of things. I've been fascinated by your father, who was a great defensive mind and player and coach, kind of turning the offense and Andre Ware loose and coaching Andre to a Heisman Trophy. And Andre was so emotional when your father passed. Andre just talked about the indebtedness and gratefulness to having been coached by your dad and so on. Tell us what you kind of remember about that dynamic. Your dad, a great defensive guy, but has this offense scoring ridiculous points.
Well, you know, it really goes back to my dad's first head coaching job with the Chicago Bears back in 1975. My dad, he took a chance on a young man who was at an HBCU, a running back that at the time had never, you know, you would never go to an HBCU back in the 70s to draft your first pick in the draft from the HBCUs. But my dad got to know and took a chance on a guy named Walter Payton. And he drafted Walter as his first pick in that draft and changed history. And I think Walter Payton changed the running back position when he played. My dad believed in giving the ball to Walter 40 times a game. Like 36, if you go look at the Bears stats, I mean, it's crazy. It's 35 carries, 40 carries. But what had happened, I think, over time, and my dad did that because he was a defensive guy. He was like, let's kill the clock, let's play slow football, let's do all of that. But I think as time went on, when my dad went to the Redskins, he went home to Washington where he played. You know, he tried to do the same thing. He had John Riggins as his running back. Riggins was a little bit beat up, and then Riggins held out in 1979. He decided to not play that year. He just decided, I'm not going to play. It was a contract dispute, something that my dad had no control over. Mm-hmm. And because of that, they had a really bad season. And ultimately, my dad was fired at the end of that year. My dad realized at that point, he's like, you know what? Yeah, football has evolved, and I have to evolve as well. And so he went to the USFL in 1982, coaching the Houston Gamblers. And that was after spending a year out in San Diego as defensive coordinator with Air Coryell. He got to work for a passing offense, seeing how that works. He then brought in Mouse Davis as his offensive coordinator with the Gamblers. We had Jim Kelly as the quarterback, and then the run and shoot became a professional offense. He took it from there to the University of Houston. At the time, the University of Houston was in the Southwest Conference. Everybody used to run the triple option, which was invented at the University of Houston, by the way. Coach Bill Yeoman invented the Veer offense beat Texas with it, and so Texas copied it and made the what they called the wishbone. The Veer was a great offense, but it had been played out. It was 20 years in existence, and we came in and put the run and shoot in, and we changed history as players and my dad as a coach. You know, Andre and David Klingler, who was the backup quarterback and ended up playing the next year, they still hold many records today. You have to evolve. You know, my dad always said, you know, you're never too old to learn something new. And I try to, again, emulate that at my age today. My dad was smart enough to say, hey, let's take a look at an offense that was a little bit different. And it really helped bring in, it ushered in the four wide receivers and five wide receiver sets that we see today.
It's incredible. And I think about your dad's willingness to adapt. And I think about Buddy Ryan saying, oh, the chuck and duck, you know, referring to it with derision. But, you know, Buddy, I'm a great defensive coach, no doubt, but maybe didn't have the same sort of open mind and adaptability that your father did, to his great credit. Final thing, and there's, again, Ted, I feel like we could talk forever about all of these things, but I do want to, and I really appreciate your time. John and I both do, and I know our listeners do. We are here now in our world in Corvallis, a world that Houston football experienced. We've had the dissolution of the Pac-12 conference. You went through that in the Southwest Conference that you alluded to, and it felt like you were tell us what those years were like when the Southwest imploded and off goes Texas, A&M, Tech, and Baylor to the Big 12, TCU, SMU, and Rice to the WAC, and Houston to Conference USA. 27 years later, you're kind of made whole again, getting back to the Big 12. But Ted, what was that all like? What's it been like?
Well, it was horrible. I wish I could tell you anything better, but you know, to go from being in a conference where, you know, we beat Texas. When I was in school, I beat them 3 out of the 4 years that I played them. We dominated Texas. Yeah. I'm not afraid of UT, and nor should anybody else who wears the red and white at the University of Houston. But then what happens is this was all handled, by the way, and you can look up the history on it. It was all done at the Texas State Legislature. This was a political football, and Houston didn't play ball. We did not play politics. And because of that, we were in a bad situation for 20 plus years, 26 years. And, you know, my only advice, to the folks, at Oregon State would be, you know, lobby your politicians. Don't let yourselves get left out. Don't let one school get a pass and one school not get a pass. You got to band together and you got to stick together because look what happened to Houston. Houston was outside looking in. It affects your budgets. It hurts your fan attendance. It hurts everything. And it took Houston a long time, a lot of hard work. A lot of great work was done by athletic director Chris Pesman, who was unfortunately fired last year, but he got us back into the Big 12. And he was a former teammate of mine, a guy that played with me, but because he understood what it was like back in the Southwest Conference days. It can be tough, but, you know, when you win football games, it solves all your problems. And Houston was able, even though they were in the American, they were in Conference USA first and then the American Athletic Conference, even though they were there, they did beat Florida State in a, in one of the New Year's Six Bowls. That kind of helped with get a little bit more national exposure. Houston had a couple other big wins. They beat Lamar Jackson when he was at, the year he won the Heisman, at Louisville. So, you know, you just got to win football games is what it comes down to, and with fewer resources, which is a really hard challenge. But I don't think Oregon State's going to have a problem. I really don't. I think you guys will be right back into a major conference here very soon.
Ted, we like the sound of that, but I mean, Case Keenum's big career probably helps too, right? To have guys that are relevant on a national stage, does that help? I mean, for Oregon State now in a rebuilt Pac-12 that begins next year, which the best of the Mountain West, Texas State joining, you know, how does Oregon State, Washington State, and so on in new worlds, how can it stay in a sense in the national and public eye so that in the next wave, maybe it doesn't take 27 years to get back to a quote-unquote Power Four type status?
Well, you got to do the hard path. You know, you got to go beat good teams. And it takes time to rebuild programs. You know, look, in the world that we live in today with the transfer portal, you know, every single season,
teams lose a handful of players or maybe half their roster in some situations, right? So you have to give the players a reason to be there, and you gotta do a really great job of managing your roster and getting a great team on the field, and then you got to go play tough opponents, which a lot of teams don't want to do. And even the SEC, you know, we all heard a couple of weeks ago, the SEC is going to probably cut one of their games out and force them to play a Power Five school. So they're going to give even fewer opportunities to the you know, other conferences that are out there that are all trying to get quality teams to play them. It's going to be harder and harder. I mean, this is a big time. This is exactly how we felt for years at the University of Houston, was that, you know, we wanted to play good teams, but we, you know, sometimes we got embarrassed when we played them. But it took time. We brought in some really good coaches, like Kevin Sumlin was a great coach for us for a few years. Tom Herman was a great coach for us for a few years. And those guys went on runs that got us that national exposure, that gave us a seat at the table to have the conversation.
Yeah.
And then our donors helped out. We literally went to Austin, Texas. We lobbied the state legislature. We got all of the politicians in the state legislature that have a degree from the University of Houston. We got them to commit to support us getting into a big time conference. If we hadn't done all of those things, we would not be in the position that we're in today.
Ted, thank you so much. This has been a fascinating conversation. Appreciate your touching on so many different things, including starting with the game itself Friday night. We hope
it's going to be a great game.
Yeah, we look forward to it. Have you ever been out here in your life, in your travels?
You know, it's one of the rare places that I have not been. I haven't been to Reser Stadium. I'm excited about the opportunity. I understand it's been recently upgraded, renovated. I'm super excited to come to Oregon. And, you know, it's such a – what a storied program Oregon State is, and what an honor it is for the University of Houston to have this opportunity to play them. It's going to be quite a pleasure for us.
Ted, thank you for your time, a generous amount of it. Look forward to meeting you Friday at Reser. Thanks for joining us, Ted. I hope we can do it again.
You bet, Mike. Thank you. Look forward to seeing you.
Thank you. How about that? A really good guest, yeah. Johnny. A really good guest.
It's they're Jim Wilson, and he had it.
Ted Pardee, son of the legendary Jack Pardee, and I love the part. I mean, his tribute to his father, when I asked about what was it like playing for Bear or George, did he tell stories? No. He loved on us, and he coached us up, and he didn't really it doesn't sound like Jack is sitting there at the dinner table saying, well, I remember the time Bear came up to me, and he said, no, I mean, good stuff on so many levels, including the big piece about fighting at the legislative level. Whatever you do to fight and fight, and yeah, just make sure that you don't, the next wave or whatever is going to happen, the Beavers got to make the most of these next 5-6 years, whatever that's going to look like, be relevant, win games, go through the tough times. It's a bit of an exile in a sense. I mean, it's a bit of a wilderness journey, but just keep doing the best you can with it. Win games, be relevant, recruit well, develop the best you can in the changing era that we're in. And it took 27 years for Houston to be made whole. I don't think it's going to take Oregon State that long in this new era.
No, and I couldn't help but think, as he was saying, don't, you know, get your legislature involved, your politics involved. I couldn't help but think that's too late.
Too late.
Because that window
that ship has sailed.
Was open, and there was some early discussion, but it kind of closed, and here we are now, probably a year or two later. It feels like it's too late, but it may come up again. But I liked what he said, because don't let one school get something that the other school doesn't. And unfortunately, that happened.
But he did say, too, that in the recent being made whole, and again, it was going with University of Houston donors and so on to the legislature and beating the drum and pounding on the drum to get back into a quote-unquote power count.
Yeah, I don't think it'll take – I hope it won't take 26 years.
I don't believe it will. But it's a big game Friday night, and Ted Pardee broke it down on a lot of levels. Some great football history, life lessons, a look at the matchup. If you have any thoughts about that or anything else, open phones down the stretch, 541-497-5356, 541-497-5356. And he did talk about Bill Yeoman introducing the split veer and triple option football, taken to the next level, so that what Jerry Pettibone ran and the wishbone Emory Ballard in Texas and Daryl Royal, but Emory Ballard, who installed the wishbone, that was another level. The constant evolving nature of football strategies is a fascinating thing. And so the split veer was introduced by Bill Yeoman to college football, the triple option, but with a quarterback and split running backs. The wishbone then added the fullback component and a full house backfield.
So what is an example then of the Pettibone offense with a really prolific passing game? Can you do both?
It's a good question, and I don't think so.
Because even though it didn't work for a while, there was that UCLA game in 94.
Oh, there were.
Oregon State looked great running that.
A well-oiled machine at times, and it just Lou Holt still believes that any kind of option offense, well-executed, in Lou Holtz's brilliant football mind, is the best offense. He said, if I came back to coach today, I would run some sort of veer option, triple option.
And those
approach
only work when you have the utmost of discipline. You have to have it.
Right.
And in this day and age, when we're hearing today, well, we're supposed to be doing this, but we're not. Okay, that won't fly. you got to get the players to do what they're supposed to do.
Let's take a break. Anything you'd like to contribute, feel free. 541-497-5356.
All right, let's get to some text, shall we?
Thank you, John.
Okay, let's go back to the beginning earlier anyway. The Platypus Trophy was talked about at the annual pregame gatherings where reps from both schools were present. When I first moved to Oregon in the late 80s and the early 90s, after those ended, which is too bad, I think the Platypus was retired. That's from Dave from outside of Sandy.
Thank you, Dave.
Lived here 66 years, Platypus Trophy never carried any significance.
Okay, that sounds right. That resonates. That rings true. Thank you.
My first Beaver game was the 1964 win over Oregon. That 7-6 victory put OSU in the Rose Bowl. In my 60-plus years following the Civil War, I've never heard of a Platypus Trophy. I don't want one now. I'm over the Ducks.
Thank you for that. And that's right. That win did put the Beavers in. Oregon probably would have gone had Oregon won 7-6. Al East blocks an extra point. The late Al East, bless his heart. Booker Washington scores the touchdown with about 2 minutes left, and the Beavs hold on to win. But it took a week, 8 to 10 days, after the chancellor's vote and of that, before you knew you were going, because USC had the temerity to beat John Heward and Notre Dame, and that pushed the L.A. sports writers and everybody to say, USC should go to the Rose Bowl. I don't care what Oregon State just did. And there were writers saying it was a travesty, the L.A. writers, that Oregon State got voted in to go. It took a vote. So that's why the 64 game, although it was, in a sense, the winner would go, most likely, it wasn't like the one and only 2009 when it was absolutely rock solid, the winner goes.
Yeah, and I think that was that the one where Steve Priest was told while walking across campus?
Bob Grimm.
Yeah, Bobby 64. Grimm, yeah. Dear Joe Beaver Show, as I started my day this morning, I read that an American college football team, OSU, with the colors orange and black, had let their football coach go. I was in shock, had me worried. Then I woke more up and saw that it was the team hammered earlier in the season by the Ducks, and not the team from last Saturday. Bring on Houston Friday night, go Beavs. Doug from Salem.
Thank you, Doug. And Gundy was fired. By the way, according to the Houston notes put together by Fletcher Like, Wilsonville High School parents both went to Oregon State and met there. And Fletcher, who's now working for Houston, put in his notes that the Big 12 did away with the preseason media poll this year after getting things so wrong last year. So like, hey, we were so bad, we're not going to run anything out there.
Yeah, they had ASU last.
They picked Utah to win it last year. Utah ended up finishing 13th. They picked Oklahoma State to finish third last year, and Oklahoma State went winless and finished 16th. So this year they said, we ain't doing a poll.
Oh, okay. Who's this? This is Reynolds. Says, great job. The Ted Party interview was great journalism. An hour would have been awesome.
Yeah.
He was very good. Very good.
Thank you, Reynolds.
Here's another one. Been listening for many years. Ted Pardee is one of the best guests you guys have ever had on.
Yes.
Great stories. His dad should have a biography about his life. Can't write the story of college football without him.
Yeah, and he is in the College Football Hall of Fame, Jack, is playing at A&M and one of the original Junction boys as well. I mean, and just an amazing football life, but sounds like a good man.
I only remember him as a Redskins coach.
Right. Well,
with a
as the head coach of the Redskins, he succeeded my hero, my hero, George Allen, and George got fired after the 77 season, went 9-5 and missed the playoffs, gone. And so Jack, though, got off to a 6-0 start in 78, and I had enough love for the Redskins then. 6-0 in 78, including a 9-5 win over the Dallas Cowboys in Monday Night Football, and I was still all in on the Redskins. But they were playing Joe Theismann over Billy Kilmer, and that hurt me. Mm. And they ended up missing the playoffs and going 8-8 after a 6-0 start. And Billy came in and rescued a couple of wins from Joe when Joe slumped. Billy was my last football hero.
Wow.
Anyway,
wow.
Anything else on the text line?
That's it.
Thank you. And thank you for your contributions, Ronald. I agree with you on that evaluation, by the way. Open phones here down the stretch, 541-497-5356. 541-497-5356.
Well, Gundy gone at Oklahoma State, and you had who was the first one? It was Deshaun Foster at UCLA. Mm-hmm. So midseason firings they're happening. It's not something that doesn't happen. But you know, I think if the Beavers can fix a few things that are fixable, they're fixable. They can actually put up a fight and see what happens on Friday night.
I don't
think that it's a guarantee that they lose. I know 12.5 points is a lot.
Somebody said to me today that it's now 13.5.
Oh, so really?
Whatever, wow. Whatever that original number floated has gone up.
Wow.
So that's fine. I don't mind it, actually.
Yeah.
I think the Beavers are going to have their best game of the year, a complete game. As Jim Wilson keeps saying, we want to see that. And
yeah.
I thought, I know it's a stretch. I know some people were a little upset when Trent at his halftime exit interview said something about we're right where we want to be.
Yeah.
Oh, you're down 2 touchdowns. That's right where you want to be. And when you're losing games, anything you say, anything that doesn't go quite right can become fodder for people to ridicule and be derisive and criticize. I think what he meant was that first half of football. I'm not trying to go Ben from being there, interpreting everything Chauncey. I think what our insightful young friend is saying is, I don't want to go quite Jerzy Kosinski and being there per se, but I understood what Trent was saying. That half of football against a great team in their house wasn't bad, John. It was
right. Pretty
decent competitive football, and I think Trent was saying we're right where we want to be in terms of how we're playing,
and
we've got a shot. We've come on the road in this atmosphere. He didn't say all of that. I'm putting words in his mouth. But when he says right where we want to be, no, you don't want to be 2 touchdowns out at halftime.
Right.
But that game moved closer, I thought, to an approximation of clean football in different phases of the game. And put it together Friday night at home, I think there's going to be a tremendous sense of urgency.
Yeah.
Everybody keeps saying have it. They will. They're going to play their best football Friday night, I believe. And I think that can lead them to a victory and the first of many to build on from this Friday night. I believe it's possible.
You ready for some Mariner talk?
Please.
All right. Mariners tonight.
Yes.
Starting as the final 6 games, regular season. One thing that got lost in the shuffle of battling it out with Houston for the American League West title was the overall championship, or at least the overall record, to avoid the wild card deal and go straight to the divisional playoffs.
Which they have a shot at.
They're 2 games ahead of Detroit.
Right.
Now, what's going on with the Guardians and Stephen Kwan? Because right now, Detroit is on a 6-game slide while the Mariners are on a 4-game winning streak.
And the Guardians have been red hot, making a push for a possible
playoff still alive.
Spot. They've won 15 of their last 17. Stephen Kwan and the Guardians were 15.5 games behind on July 8th, behind Detroit. 15.5 games behind. They're 1 game behind entering this final week. And Detroit will be at Cleveland, a 3-game series starting today. So
here we go.
This is a fun final week.
It is.
Of Major League Baseball. Not something you would know if you tuned into National Sports Talk Radio.
No.
Because it's nothing. I mean, nothing but the NFL.
Right.
And that Colin talked college football briefly today. Did you hear him? And here's what I love Colin. He's brilliantly talented and one of the best and highest paid guys, and he's deserved it.
I didn't like what he said.
Did you hear what he said about, don't give me Stanford and Arizona State?
Yes, I didn't like
that.
That
whole rant.
It was too regional.
Yeah,
too regional.
Yeah,
now it's much better.
Football was too regional.
Yeah, that's the whole, that was the whole positive of it.
That to me is the,
That's what made it great.
That's what makes us totally opposite in our view of the world.
Yeah.
Well, it's because you're at Oregon State and you know you were left behind because the marketplace spoke. Colin's big into market and economics and money and all that. He thinks it's better now that he said, I've got Oregon going to Penn State. That sounds big, he says. I've got Ohio State and Washington. Yeah. That sounds big. That's Colin's point of view, and he ain't alone, but that's what the talking heads have done to us.
And I think
instead of making it a regional, beautiful regional phenomenon,
which
we're
going
to narrow this down to these power teams so I can have a matchup in Happy Valley this weekend. I'm sick of it. I hate it.
No, he's talking the opposite of what was great about it for decades. Yeah. That was the whole point. That was the whole reason for, you know, being an alumnus and cheering on your team and following your school around, and it was all about the pageantry and the band and everything about it and the student athlete aspect of the whole thing. NIL has just killed that. It's killed that. Now that's separate from the dissolution of the conferences, but this idea, he's actually voicing the very thing no one would voice before, because they would say, no, these regional games are great. But now he's voicing, well, this is great. Who cares that there's been a whole bunch of teams that have been left out and killed rivalries. This is great. Now, every week, I've got big names to watch.
That's what he is saying on behalf of football fans that have been, to me, led down this road from the talk in the early 90s, got to settle it on the field. I'll say that for the rest of my life. That kind of talk made me nervous in 1993, John.
And here we are, 30-some-odd years later.
Because Colin, a great talent and an announcer and a co-worker. I love the guy. I mean, he's brilliant, what he's done in his career. So good for him and more power to him. But is he speaking for most of you now? I think a little bit made me nervous about Merle, and his call was kind of. Because Merle's saying, well, they're in a different world now altogether, so I can watch that game in Happy Valley because it's an interesting matchup. Well, yeah, it is.
Okay.
But at the expense of a dissolution of a regional phenomenon in great league like the Pac-12.
The thing about it that's difficult, though, is that they're not wrong. Colin's right when he says Oregon-Penn State,
it's
the way Oregon
game.
Is now,
yes.
Okay, is much more interesting than, let's say, Stanford and Arizona.
Right.
I get
so
that.
So what, though?
I get that.
I get it, too.
But what you're saying, then, is you do not care about tradition. You do not care about what the whole
regionality.
Model of college sports is supposed to be, which is regionality and regional rivalries. And then you come together on the national scene later. You're saying you don't care about that. And I find it hard to give into that and say, so I live in both camps, a little bit like Merle. Yeah. Some of these games are like, well, that's an interesting one. Okay.
Ohio State at Washington, Husky Stadium
is an interesting game.
I get it.
I'll check that out, but not at the expense of the regional rivalries.
Not at the expense.
Yeah.
And that's why you would get in bowl games. That's what the great Rose Bowl in games would be for, to put Penn State against Oregon, or put Wisconsin
where it
against
would
UCLA.
Never be, where it would never be unless it was a bowl game.
So, again, you guys are screaming at the clouds as the world's moved on. So I know, but when I hear people just holding forth, even as much as someone I respect as Colin, his little foray into college football was to talk about the big games that are coming up and how that's so good for him as a fan. And he's speaking, I think, for the great unwashed and the great multitudes who say the same thing, who'll be settling in to watch some great college football matchups over the weekend. But again, that's been all at the expense of leaving behind programs like Washington State and Oregon State, proud members of a power conference for over 100 years, left behind all of that so we can have more big games to root for over the weekend.
And I think what's jarring about it is he's the first one to really come out and say it, and say it like that. Just, who cares about you little guys? He's essentially saying, who cares about you little guys? I am so much more happy about these bigger games. It's so much better than Stanford and Arizona and Cal and Colorado.
Right.
Who cares? He's the first one to say it that brazenly.
Well, he's saying it because that's the reality.
Right,
now,
it is.
And that's what they all have gotten.
Yeah.
By demanding, settle it on the field, these championships. That's that talk in 1991, 92, people upset about tie co-championships, the Huskies.
Yeah.
And Miami Hurricanes both going 12-0. I remember thinking, when everybody was saying, well, you know, talk shows were beginning to take momentum and the television shows on ESPN and elsewhere. Hey, how come we can't get a playoff like the other divisions have? And Ken Go, love Ken Go, but he was saying, oh, all the other divisions settle their championship with a playoff. How come Division I college football can't? And I would argue with Ken, and still, well, they developed the original model, a non-playoff. They had bowl games,
right,
and they had mythical national championships, but they had voters talking to UPI, AP, whatever. And that was good enough for decades. I just felt like we didn't need to lose that because here's what we've got instead.
And it worked all the way up until they started doing the playoff, because the only, I mean, I'm sure there was plenty of controversy back in the day, 40s, 50s, 60s, about, and then they'll yell across the aisle. No, it was this team. Okay, fine. But there were two championships in 2003. That was the last time. And you know what? Both those schools, LSU and USC,
have trophies.
And they both claim that they were the national champions.
Same in 1991.
Right. And it's okay. It's okay to have that.
Yeah, I agree.
And you kept everything in line. You kept the regionality of things. You kept it all together. And I don't know. He just, it was surprising to me that he went so hard to that direction.
It was brazen. Okay. The Mariners' amazing run, a magic number of three, looking for their first division title since 2001. Did you know that Aaron Judge closing in on a batting title, and he's going to win the batting title, it would appear, unless he just goes in a dreadful slump here this last week, will be the tallest batting champion in Major League Baseball history. That was a note that I saw that.
What is he, 6'5"?
6'7". And you're right, the 6'5". Dave Parker, Frank Thomas, Joe Mauer, John Olerud, and Derek Lee, previous batting champions at 6'5". They are the tallest batting champions. Judge at 6'7" is about to be the tallest batting champion.
No one will beat that record.
Probably not.
No one will beat that record.
But it is a final interesting week. And a retraction yesterday, both of the split veer, introduced by Bill Yeoman, not the full wishbone that came from Emory Ballard in Texas and Daryl Royal. And then, Daryl, think about this for a moment. It's amazing. And I reached out to Tim Layden, who wrote the great book Blood, Sweat, and Chalk. And we've had him on before to talk about the air raid and the evolution of offensive football, and how in the conversation we had with Ted Pardee, very interesting in terms of defenses adjusting and the way you broke it down and saying, okay, here's how defenses have adjusted to the air raid. And so what the air raid people have done, okay, well, we need to adjust. So now the more 12 personnel using tight ends, more. And Mike Leach, he said, he believed, Ted said, would have evolved into, okay, they've caught up a little bit with some of what we want to do. So we'll use the tight end, maybe even two on occasion. Leach himself, Ted thought he might have come around to that. But in the midst of all of that, that the evolution, I mentioned the split beer, yes, it was introduced by Bill Yeoman. Another retraction from yesterday, he didn't introduce a triple option. Daryl Royal shared it with everybody. Daryl had it at Texas and virtually unstoppable, but when Daryl knew that coaches that he liked were in trouble, he would say, hey, look, let's take our
stuff and
give it to them.
Yeah.
Gave it to Barry Switzer, and then he never beat Barry Switzer again at Oklahoma.
Yes, I've heard that.
That's amazing. That says something about Daryl Royal having a heart for coaches. And like Mike Leach was a coach's coach, and I'm sure would probably sit and break down and talk to anybody at a moment's notice about his four verticals. And we just say, run, and we'll get the ball to you. Find the open space, and we'll get the ball to you. And that's all he ever did. It was simple.
Yeah,
incredibly productive.
I don't know how two down tackles and four-point stance or whatever he was saying in those positions changes that. I really don't. even with his explanation, I'd have to go back, listen to it, and slow
and
it down.
Study it.
To say, okay, now what is he, because I can envision all the positions and everything, but I'd like to slow it down to hear really what he was talking about, because it doesn't make a lot of sense. Bottom line is, if his receivers are open because they're going out and the quarterback is just going and saying, find him. And if no one knows, then how do you defend it?
Apparently it's being reined in a little bit, like the days of stopping are long gone, said Rocky. But he was wrong. The zone read and all of that has been reined in to some extent. I mean, after those days in the mid-2000s.
You and I.
And it's because defenses did adjust and started stopping it. on a more regular basis, so offenses had to continue to evolve. You still believe that if somebody ran that stuff that Chip was doing in those early days, that it would be unstoppable again? I don't think so, but somebody would.
It was too many quarterbacks were getting hurt. That's the problem.
Okay.
Too many quarterbacks.
So too many quarterbacks getting hurt, but the offense itself was, quote, unstoppable.
I think so.
Okay. Well, Rocky Long thought so. The days are
I'd like to talk with Rocky and see if he still thinks that.
Okay. Now, to me, that's all interesting stuff, but a retraction made by yours truly, as well as, why in the world did I call? Did you see the throw? The throw.
Yes.
The Justin Herbert throw to Keenan Allen.
Did you
see
it? I
kept saying Noah Allen. Yeah, I've seen it. Noah. Where I came up with Noah when Keenan, a recent acquisition, played for Cal, and we know the Keenan Allen world. It was Keenan Allen on the receiving end, not Noah. My apologies for that. Did you? That
throw, it was incredible.
It's incredible.
Because he was about to be tackled.
No, it's an amazing throw. But is it? I mean, people were talking about it as the greatest throw they'd ever seen.
It looked very difficult to where it could be in that category.
The degree of difficulty was very high.
Yes,
he climbed the pocket, too.
Because it wasn't just kind of a fling, a short pass to get out of trouble. He was in the grass. It was a bullet.
And the strength involved to make that pass at the angle that he was at, and two defenders that he threaded the needle. It is an incredible pass.
It is.
No question.
It is.
The greatest pass ever.
Well,
we saw it.
Anytime argue about the GOAT, you're going to have argument.
We are not prisoners of the moment. It was the greatest pass ever. Hey, thanks, everybody. John and Brooks tomorrow, Thursday at Timber Hill. We look forward to seeing you there, 11 to 1 on Joe Radio.